From the studio of WHUP, LP Hillsboro, this is Murmur, a Modern School film program. My name is Robert Milazzo, and over the next hour together, we'll explore where culture meets craft. On today's show, artist, painter, collagist, filmmaker, writer, traveler, oh yeah, and he's a photographer too, Larry Clark. Welcome. Welcome to Murmur. Good to have you here with us. This is Robert Milazzo. Murmur is a Modern School of Film program. Really cool show for you today. Special guest ringing in. We have a website, murmurradio.com. We have social handles at MSF Murmur. This is Instagram, Twitter. The email is murmurradio@gmail.com. Send us a line. Let us know you're listening. Ask us a question, a comment. What else do we have? We have the Modern School of Film website, modernschoolfilm.com, apropos. And we'll also be on the road. We'll be in Hawaii October 8th with Brian Michael Bendis. So come to Honolulu and listen to us talk movies with Brian Michael Bendis, comic book icon. It's going to be a lot of fun. Speaking of icons and social handles and things of that nature. We have an Instagram handle at MSF Murmur is the Instagram. So, A, you should follow us, despite what I'm about to say. I'm not a big fan of Instagram. I think it's changed and rearticulated and dearticulated how we look at photos and pictures. And I think it's given these words less meaning or changed the meaning. But I know as a filmmaker, a film teacher, when I talk to my students about filmmaking and I think of filmmakers, I actually start with still photographers and still photography. There's a lot to be learned from the icons, historical icons, and we have one with us today, Larry Clark. Before we meet Larry and talk to him, he's back. This is kind of a great time for Larry now. Yeah, not that he went anywhere, but he's back from going nowhere. You know what I mean. He's been around. Anyway, he's never gone anywhere. You know what I mean. I'll stop now. The fall is also a really nice time for us because we get to travel. We're going to Hawaii to do an event. But we were in a place where I think you should visit, actually. Let me tell you a little bit about New Granada.
Welcome to New Granada, where people come to escape city life. It has safe streets, clean air, good schools. It's a perfectly planned community, but something strange is happening. Something that wasn't part of the plan.
Seems to me like you all were in such a hopped-up hurry to get out of the city that you turn your kids into exactly what you're trying to get away from.
Something that could drive this town over the edge.
You are to take these home to your parents. It's to let them know about a special emergency meeting to discuss the problems about your people. Mommy's
all right. Kid who tells on another kid. It's a dead kid. Oh!
I don't know how many of us are willing to admit just how deep in trouble some of the kids in this city are.
Tension is rising.
You people talk about these kids like they're a bunch of animals.
Tempers are raging.
Your son and some of his friends are part of this.
My son and his friends are part of this town.
Time is running out. And something's got to explode.
They've got guns!
Keep cool! I can assure you everything is under control.
They were old enough to know better, but too young to care. And now this town is over the edge.
afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans.
There was a time when we were afraid of artists in this country. Now we seem to just be afraid of politicians and, another story for another day. But we were actually afraid of artists. I thought that was a good thing and a good time. And we were afraid of films and we were afraid of music and we were afraid of artistic cultural contributions. And one person that I'm not afraid of because I admire so much, but I think he's a really interesting symbol and an artist for that idea of danger and the toothlessness of some art now. But this man is far from toothless. He needs no introduction. I'm going to try one. Well, I'm not going to give you the back introduction. I'll give you what he's up to now. He just launched a show. It was the inaugural show at the UTA Artist Space, which was the largest display of his work, including his seminal works, Tulsa, Teenage Lust, some new collages and paintings, and never before seen series called Heroin, and also a Tulsa 16mm film counterpart. What I'm sure he's most excited about, though, is he's one of the new faces of Dior Homme, which is a fall-winter campaign by Dior, and their creative director had his work, Larry Clark's work, on a mood board and made him one of the faces of the Dior campaign. So if he's not proud of that, I'm sure he's most proud of 2002 Teenage Caveman, a film which I love. The one thing I know for sure, his name is Larry Clark. His favorite color is green, and he's here on Murmur. Larry, welcome to Murmur, man. Good to have you with us.
Great, man. You know, good to be back in New York. I've been traveling like crazy, and I'm happy to be home. I got in late last night from Tokyo and San Diego to Paris, so I'm not leaving my studio for 2 days.
Do you ever take a? I mean, are you past the point of taking a step back and saying, "Man, that's not a bad deal"? I mean, I know the jet lag and the physical demands. But are you in a sort of satisfied place now? I mean, is this a new place because you've traveled and displayed your art. But is this a kind of new place for you?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this is new, especially because I'll be 74 in January and I'm super healthy, and I made it through all the kind of stuff that a lot of people go through at my age. I mean, I had like a major spinal surgery, and they put 14 titanium screws in my spine. Then I broke my wrist making a film, and they had to put a metal plate in it. Jeez. And then I had both knees replaced 1 year ago. So now I'm, you know, after that, I should like live to be 100, man. So I'm very happy, very satisfied. Yeah.
Be careful what you wish for, man. Do you want to live that long?
I want to live forever.
How many of these injuries are old skateboard injuries? Is anything from your day's research?
Well, skateboarding certainly didn't help my arthritis with my knees. And like I had arthritis so bad in my knees, with bone on bone, I was in pain for years, you know. So finally, I had the operation 1 year ago this month. And like nowadays, it's like a bread and butter operation. They do them, you know, bang, 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 they want to do them one at a time, and then you rehab one, then they do the second. And I thought that was dumb. Why would you do one and still be in pain and rehab one and have to do it again? So I insisted on two. The doctor said I was too old. They also said I was too old. It couldn't be done, and I insisted. I actually fought with the doctor for about 2 months about it. And then I took all the tests, and my heart was very strong. So he did it, man. So I had two at the same time.
Well, one thing
no more pain. What? No more pain, man.
One thing I didn't put in the introduction of you is you're a survivor, and obviously You know, it's not easy out there, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, we were talking earlier about we used to be afraid of artists. Now we're kind of afraid of politicians. Let's go backwards a little bit, just because you literally, and thank you, man, because I know you just came in from Tokyo. What was Tokyo like? What's it like there now?
Tokyo is a great city for me, and I've been just about everywhere except there's some South American countries that I would love to go to that I haven't been to Guatemala, and I haven't been to Colombia and places like that, but it seems that when I've been invited to those places, it's when some terrible civil war or something going on is very dangerous, or they're kidnapping, you know, anybody that's American. So
yeah.
I haven't been able to go to those countries yet. But I will. But anyway, what I was going to say was the three most livable cities for me would be New York, Paris, and Tokyo.
Wow.
Tokyo is wonderful. And like I'm like a rock star there, man. I mean, when I had my first spinal surgery, where they put all the titanium screws in me, my arthritis in my spine was so bad that I was collapsing, and I would have been an old man bent over double staring at the sidewalk, right?
Right.
So it was kind of an emergency, but I had a really good surgeon, one of the best in the world, Dr. Frank Moore, and I knew him because he's a collector too, right? You know, he like collects art. So he had actually collected some of my work. So he did the operation, so anyway, it was totally cool. But what was the question?
No, what's just you're answering it. Just kind of what's the vibe there?
Tokyo.
Yeah, man.
Tokyo is so cool, man. You know. So anyway, so when I had the first operation, I was under the knife. It was supposed to take 3.5 hours. I was under the knife for 7 hours, and so it was pretty dangerous, pretty major, and I could have died.
Wow.
And so I had all these prints laying around, like tens of thousands of 4x6s, because when I started shooting color in the 80s, I just went down to the corner drugstore and, you know, and I gave them the Kodacolor, the fast Kodacolor, was 400, just like Tri-X.
Right.
And like an hour, 4 hours of the next morning, I would get all these envelopes of prints and negatives back in 36 color 4x6s for $12, and like these are the originals. So I said, what am I going to do with them, man? What are the kids going to do? They're not going to know what to do with them. So I came up with this idea of selling for $100 a piece, so that the skate kids who come to my shows could afford a souvenir, you know.
Wow.
And so I did the first one in New York with, like, Leo Fitzpatrick, who was telling kids.
Of course, yeah.
When he was 17.
Yeah.
And, like, now he's been a gallerist. He's a famous DJ, gallerist. He's a painter. Just an amazing guy. And, like, he had this little non-profit closet-sized gallery over right around the corner from Cass's Deli in New York City.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway,
right on,
the first one there.
On Ludlow, which is now totally different.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Ludlow. And so we didn't advertise it because I said, if we advertise it, I'm afraid the collection will come in because these are the vintage originals. Now, I would pick a print and, you know, have it blown up to 24x18. And then the gallery would sell it for $10,000, $12,000, $15,000. It could never, in a million years, afford it. And my audience was the kids, you know, because they knew me from my movies. They didn't really know me as a photographer until after Kids came out. And then they saw that I'd had this, you know, this career before directing films, making movies as a photographer for 50 years or something. And but now it's been 56 years.
Wow.
I've been making photographs. It's a long time.
It's I'm sorry, man.
Go on.
No, I was going to say. Yeah. And
well, I have a show in Los Angeles now.
Yeah.
It's up through October that has two prints. The first serious photographs I made in 1961 when I was 18.
Yeah.
Of Billy Mann, the guy on the cover of the Tulsa book.
Yeah.
And Johnny Bridges, this Indian, American Indian, was my best friend who never took a drug in his life, but cancer got him at about 40.
Yeah.
So my first two pictures of my two best friends are dead, have been dead for all these years, And in one of the rooms in the gallery, we're showing the Tulsa film I shot in 1968, An Hour Silent. And it's all Johnny and Billy. So I get to see them come alive. It's just amazing for me.
I was going to say, you know.
That shows up through October.
Up in L.A. at the UTA Artist Space and with Larry Clark.
Artist Space, yeah.
Yeah, with Larry Clark here on Murmur. And I was just going to say that, you know, film exhumes the ghosts in a way, you know, not to desecrate the memory of these amazing men and women.
Mm-hmm.
But it can do that, can it? It can still do that. Do you fear that, or is that a beautiful feeling? Because some people fear the past. It sounds like you dig the past and don't mind being in that space.
What do you mean film can desecrate?
Well, I mean, I didn't mean to desecrate. By saying film, by calling these men and your subjects ghosts, I think a ghost is a beautiful thing.
Uh-huh.
Some people can say a ghost is like a baggage.
Oh, it's wonderful, man, because I get to see my friends from the Zelda book come alive and this, you know, come alive, and I see them like it's yesterday, they've been dead. They've been Billy since 1970 and Johnny since about 1980. So, my God, man, it's been, you know, a long time, and here they are alive. And this film I found in my closet, actually my girlfriend found it. It had been sitting in my closet for 40 years or something, and I'd never looked at it. I cut a few negative strips out for the Tulsa book, and then threw it all back up on the shelf for 40 years. It wasn't any climate control or cans or nothing. It was just laying up there, and she found it. In like 2003 or something, and so I showed it for the first time at a retrospective in Paris at the Museum of Modern Art of the City of Paris, which is right next to the Palais de Tokyo. So it's a beautiful museum that shows the old masters and stuff. And I had a retrospective there. It was amazing, you know. And so I'm showing it for the first time in America. At this gallery, this new gallery, which I launched on September 17th, I think was the opening.
I love that you were the first artist there. I love that they gave you that space first. I think L.A. is
a big space, man. It's like 40,000 square feet. You try to fill up 40,000 square feet.
My God.
And I was able to do it. It took 3 days to hang the show. I have 8 paintings. I have 3 gigantic collages. I have prints that I made, small 8x10 prints I made in 1962 and 1963. I have the two 1961 photographs, and I have other photographs. I mean, it's just them and the film, and these new paintings nobody's seen. Series of paintings when I was
heroin, right?
I was recuperating from the back surgery for a year. And they were giving me all these drugs, right, like pharmaceutical drugs, right? And so I would have these feelings from taking these drugs, which I had to have. The doctors gave me the drugs. I had to have the drugs because of the pain from the operation. That I kind of had a vague feeling like I was doing heroin, and I hadn't done heroin. I quit heroin 11/11/98, so that's 18 years ago. So in 2014, I have these feelings like I'm doing heroin from all these prescription opiates that they're giving me like mad, right?
Mm.
And I mean, the doctors just dole them out, you know, and everybody gets a habit. And housewives get a habit. Housewives get habits and then start detoxing. They have no idea what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they're detoxing and like a junkie detoxes, and they don't even know what's going on. They freak out, you know, and it's really strange. So anyway, so I did 10 paintings, and I called them heroin 1 to 10, right? I numbered them. As I painted them, I would assign a letter clock, and then number 1, number 2, up to 10. And we're showing 8 of those paintings in the show, and they're really, really spectacular, and I think they're very good. And I have a great art collection. I have a great eye. People really admire me for my eye for collecting art. They're good paintings. I can say that without bragging, because I know they're good.
I think you're
they're
just you're reporting. I don't think you're bragging. We're with Larry Clark.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll talk about Paris a little bit. You hit in Paris, and I was thinking about Chris Marker. I guess I have two questions. Did you ever meet Marker? A and B. What is What's that scene? What is the reception there for you in Paris? I guess because you know, non-American communities of art have, it seems like, a different appreciation for photography, bless their heart. So what's it like in Paris? And did you ever meet Chris Marker in your travels?
Chris Marker.
Who did La Jetée, the photo
romance? I don't think I met him, you know. I would like to have met him, but I don't think I ever did. But I met so many people in Paris, man. I've met so many people.
I can imagine.
You know, and like I have these senior moments where I can't remember my own name.
Oh, it's so, okay, man. What's the reception for your photography in Europe, in a sense, or Paris, wherever you want to take it?
Well, Paris and Tokyo, I'm like a rock star, man. I mean, like, people stop me in the street and, you know, and because I make movies, you know, like if you're the most famous photographer in the world, back in the day, let's say back in 71 or something, when Tulsa came out of nowhere for me it didn't come out of nowhere, but it was published and it came out of nowhere for the critics, you know, all of a sudden, bang, this book, which documents the entire drug process from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
But, the first, the middle, and the end. And America, in 1971, America as a whole was halfway through the drug, the deal, right? You know,
The drug generation.
Well, you know, the what happened
post Vietnam America.
Yeah. What happens when you take drugs is first.
Tell me, man.
It's the greatest thing in the world, right? You know, drugs are the greatest thing in the world, and then in the middle period. Some doubt creeps in because some kind of, you know, if people start taking other drugs and then, you know, first it's pot, weed, and acid, and, psychedelic drugs, you know, all that, and everybody's real happy and smoking weed. And then they used to say that it wasn't a gateway drug, pot was. But idiots, of course it is, you know, because if you take a drug, and you feel great, of course you're going to want to take other drugs and feel great.
You're going to want to chase that feeling. You chase the feeling.
In 71, because in 67, 68, drugs were supposed to be good. And I already knew, because I've been taking drugs since 1950, I already knew they were bad. And so the hippie thing came along. And for us pioneers like me of the drug culture, it was great because then we had much more access to drugs because all these kids were taking drugs. And they became our friends, and so we all of a sudden, in like Tulsa, it was the first half of Tulsa, is just a small group of us kids in rooms, a very secret life. It wasn't supposed to be happening. Everything was a secret. Those pictures were never supposed to be published. They were never supposed to be seen by anybody else. I was just practicing photography, but after photographing my friends for 10 years, I had a movie and like still pictures, you know. I wanted to be a filmmaker, but I wasn't a filmmaker. I wanted to be a sculptor, a writer, but I wasn't.
Tulsa,
I had was a camera.
You first envisioned Tulsa as a film, as moving images. Is that?
Yeah. First is a book, and in 1968, I laid out the book from 62 to 68, and around 1970, I laid out, as a book because Ralph Gibson, my friend, had self-published his first book, The Somnambulist. And Ralph and I were great friends. We met in 67. I came back to New York from the Army because they had a draft back then, and I was in the Army for 2 years. So I came back to New York from the Army in 67. And Ralph came from Los Angeles, where he was born and raised, to New York, just trying to get away from L.A. He doesn't like L.A. He was raised there. Didn't have a pretty happy childhood. Just like me like getting out of Tulsa, he got to L.A. and we met in New York. And we became great friends because we were such opposites. He used to escape by sleeping all the time. He was in the Navy, and he used to go in the dark room. He learned about photography in the dark room. He used to go in the dark room and just sleep, you know. And then he would, like, sleep for days, man. And I was just the opposite. I was always awake and up, you know. And, like,
Yeah.
And like in high school, I didn't sleep for 3 years.
Well, I was thinking...
I was shooting at enemy for 3 years. So opposites attract, and so we became friends, and that's how Tulsa became a book. He did his book, and I said, I'm going to make a movie. So I went down to Tulsa with a movie camera, a Nagra, you know, for sound, and found out very quickly that you couldn't make a one-man movie because I couldn't bring other people into the scene. So I went back then. So I came back with half a book and my liking, knowing what was going to happen. I didn't know what was going to happen or where or why. But I knew it would happen, and I knew what was missing in the Tulsa book,
yeah.
Experiences that I hadn't photographed. I knew that would happen, and I knew that I was going to be there when they happened. So I photographed the whole end of the book in 71 in 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. We're talking with Larry Clark here, Murmur. Let me go back a little bit. When you were a kid, I know you talked about being sort of an ADHD kid. And were you...
Very much so.
Were you... Not to sound clinical or like a bad psychology professor here, but I was wondering about this whole... The line of drugs. Like, is that part of it for you? Like, being a teenager? And were you given Ritalin? Were you given... What were you given at that time?
Well, first of all, Robert, there was no HD,
right? ADHD,
back
right?
Then.
Exactly.
You know, you were just a bad kid, and, yes. And got sent to the principal's office, and like spent many you know months of your school year just sitting in the principal's office doing nothing because you were so hyper that you couldn't, the teachers didn't like you, they kicked you out of class. Because you were disruptive, and all you would do was just being a natural teenage boy, you know, that's all. And so when I started shooting amphetamine, it wasn't even called speed then. It was just amphetamine, you know, and it came from like World War II, because in World War II, they gave all the soldiers amphetamine pills to keep them awake, you know, for days and, you know, out killing people, because if you're out in the jungle, are out just, fighting, you know, you get tired, but you can't go to sleep because it's too dangerous. So the government thought, so all these guys came back from World War II, kind of speed freaks, but it wasn't called speed. Everybody just took amphetamine.
Diet pills.
All my friends, diet pills, right? So all my friends, like the first half of the Tulsa book, you see them after they shoot up, man. They have a rush and they bounce across the room or they turn a backward flip or they, you know, they do something. Me, it calmed me down.
Yeah.
I was skinny. I stuttered so bad I couldn't talk. I was vibrating. All of a sudden, I would take a shot of amphetamine and I would be calm, calmest person in the room, because all those photographs were taken with a rangefinder camera, very quiet. And not like a singer's reflex with the mirrors banging together and making this horrible, you know, loud sound. So after a while, no one was aware I was taking pictures. And I had a 50-millimeter lens, so I'm 2 feet away from it in tiny rooms. So all those pictures are so intimate.
Yeah.
But I was just practicing photography and very quiet and calm down. And I like photography. Robert Frank said it best once. He said, I became a photographer, so I wouldn't have to talk to anybody. and it was the same way with me.
I like to talk to people so I don't have to talk to people. But I know what you're saying. talk a little bit about, you know, again, this, not to sound like a high school science film for a second, but this idea of creating.
Robert, can I stop you for 1 second?
Yeah, man, it's your nickel. Go ahead, brother.
Not to be critical.
Yeah.
But every time that you ask me something, you apologize first.
I know.
Stop apologizing.
I'm sorry, man. I just have a lot of respect for you,
I'll
and I don't want
anything.
I appreciate that, brother. Yeah, I know.
I'm I'm just a regular guy. I'm just asking the question.
I know, man.
If it's I don't just... like it, and you're out of line, I'll tell you. But usually I just answer the question.
You always do. You've never said no to me, and I appreciate that, brother. I just have tons of respect for you, and none of this comes from any. This is not journalism. This is just two guys talking. This idea of creating under the influence, is it underrated, overrated? Is it... Where has it been in your life, and what do you say to young kids in that zone? I mean, you know, because our art is created in liquid circumstances, mm-hmm. and other kind of emotional.
Right, well, I understand the question. I understand it because like you know, since you know, like writers, like our great writers, like you know, Hemingway and all of them, you know, drank heavily and they were alcoholics. And their reasoning was they could not write without drinking, so we wouldn't have those great novels if they hadn't drank. And so I couldn't have made those photographs if I wasn't in the scene because no outsider could have come in. So I was one of the guys. There was this. A cartoon in the New Yorker. I read the New Yorker since I was 18. I left Oklahoma. And my goal in life was to get the hell out of Oklahoma, you know. And so when I was 18, I left Oklahoma. And I saw the New Yorker for the first time. And I've read it like every week since then. But since I was 18. But there was a cartoon once. And it was just like hell, a picture of hell, a drawing of hell with the devil there. And a guy, you know, in a suit or tie or dress, you know, just an old man, taking a picture of the devil in hell, or taking a picture in hell.
Right.
And there was no caption, but the joke was, you can't take pictures of hell if you're outside of hell. You have to be inside.
Right.
So Tulsa's like that.
Yeah.
You could not be, you know, outside. No outsider could come in. You had to be in that life to be able to take those pictures. And I just happened to have a camera. It was all happenstance, you know. It was all serendipity, you know. It just happened. I was practicing my photography, and I grew up on what back then were called grade B movies because there was no TV, so they made tons of movies. And so I grew up every Saturday. Are you there?
Yeah, man.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
I must be getting a call coming in.
It's okay. I'm with you.
I grew up every Saturday watching film noir, right, with all the blacks and the whites and the shadows.
Yeah.
They were all black and white movies, and the shadows for emotion and light. And I learned from watching the movies that you could, get emotion. You could do anything with light and shadow.
Mm.
And so for me, photography is not what they call photography today. It's a different kind of photography. For me, photography is about light and feeling, period. That's it. You know, there's nothing else, light and feeling. And today, these terrible photographers, who take flash pictures and wash out all the light and wash out all the shadows, it's just like flash on the camera, straight in the face. Terrible, terrible. Like Terry Richardson, who is like an acquaintance of mine, and maybe even slightly we're very friendly. He's the worst photographer in the world. Terrible, because he was like raised on pornography, and pornography used to be so overlit. Remember, it was all just overlit. It was just like there was no shadows, no light.
It's almost like a Polaroid.
Had a pimple on her.
Yeah.
Had a pimple in her, a red pimple somewhere in her body. It popped out, right? Because they were also overlit. So he somehow, got hung up on pornography, I guess, when he was young, and that terrible lighting, and had this terrible style of washing out everything with flash in the camera. Taking the same picture every time for years and years and years, and like fashion thought it was different because it was different. You know, nobody was taking that picture that bad. The photographers used to, try to make good photographs, and so he came out with these bad photographers, and got rich and famous for a while. But he's the worst photographer in the world, and I tell him that to his face.
From you, it's probably a compliment, And he kind of started that quotational style in a weird way, which I'm not a fan of either. It's that Instagram style, throw up a high five, throw up your two fingers, throw up a
Well, it all comes from overlit pornography, and he's used to being ragged in that way because his father, Bob Richardson, was a very well-known fashion photographer, famous, pretty good fashion photographer from the 60s, who later became a homeless drug addict and lost all his teeth and disappeared for 20 years.
Yeah.
And that was Terry's father. And like a Terry, when his father like resurfaced, he just would call Terry and say, "You're the worst photographer in the world. I'm the best, And why can't I get a job now? You get all the jobs." And so Terry, had his own cross to burden, to bear. And so his father has passed on now. Bob is a nice guy like Bob. I met him when he came back here like a few years ago, and he just passed away a few years ago. So I've kind of taken his place in Terry's life when I see him. Rarely now. He just had twins and he's moved to L.A., so I don't see him, but he has twin little kids now, just babies, and he moved to L.A., so I don't see him. But when I used to see him, I would always tell him he was the worst photographer in the world, so I was kind of taking
We need people like that in our life. A couple other things I want to cover with you.
Sure.
The firm grasp of the obvious, this Instagram nation we live in now. Two questions. Mm-hmm. What do you make of it in general? And do you take pictures on your iPhone and what goes through your mind or your smartphone or whatever? But what about this Instagram nation we're in now? What do you make of it?
Okay, I can talk about that easily. kids today... I made this French movie called The Smell of Us in French. All French cast and crew. I was the only gringo in the crowd, man. Everybody was French. The movie is in French. It opened in Paris like about a year and a half ago. And then we had some trouble with the distributors who were lying, cheating, crooks, just like most all distributors and producers are lying, cheating, crooks. So anybody young listening to this goes into the film business, and let me tell you, man, they're all crooks, so be careful. If you don't have Final Cut like I do, they'll take your film and just change it. They show the audiences. The audiences like the ending. They're ready to shoot a new ending. They don't care what the director says. So I'm a Final Cut director. Every film I've made, nobody can change a frame. That's why I've never made a big Hollywood blockbuster or a Hollywood movie, except the second one with Jimmy Woods.
Another Day in Paradise. Another Day in Paradise.
Yes. And Vincent Kartheiser, who was 18 or 19 in the movie, and Natasha Gregson Wagner, who played Rosie, Bobby's girlfriend in the movie, Vince's girlfriend in the movie, who is Natalie Wood's daughter.
Amazing.
So it was Hollywood City, but it was a great experience because my first film, Kids, had no actors, and my second film, I wanted to work with actors because I had never worked with actors. But back to your Instagram.
Yeah.
The kids today, it's a different world. And my daughter's 30, my son's 33, so I watched them grow up with the internet. So I was curious about what happens, with these new kids, and that's, because it was a different world. And so this French film that I made, which we were buying back from the distributors, and if I ever see these guys, I'm 70, I'll be 74 years old, and I can't fight anymore because I can't hardly move. But if I can get one punch in, I hit really hard. Never need a punch.
It's all you need. All you need is one good punch.
Yeah. So this guy who lied to me, and I was so nice to him and did him a big favor with the film. But anyway, The Smell of Us will be in America and Tokyo and everywhere next year. I just approved the new subtitles for it. And it's about kids and the internet and how kids get in trouble over the internet, because kids grow up today and it's second nature. It's like, you know, it's like brushing your teeth, or with a kid, maybe it's like not brushing your teeth.
Right.
It's just natural. You know, everything is posted. You read about people, kids getting in trouble every day in the newspapers. Kids go to parties, and there's alcohol and drugs and, you know, rock and roll and, you know, drunk girls and, you know, you're trying to get laid and fights maybe and blood. But everything is photographed and everything is videoed and they post it. It's like if they didn't post it, if no photographs were made and no video was made at these parties that they go to every week, every weekend or every night or whatever, did it really happen? It's like if a tree falls in the woods and nobody is there to see it fall, does it make a sound?
Right.
Well, of course it does, but you can't prove it because nobody was there. So it's like if there was a party and all these things happened and nobody Instagrammed the pictures or videoed it, was it really a party? Did it really happen? I doubt it. You know, it's like the old tree falls in the woods.
So it's proof of life? Instagram is proof of life? Is that a troubling thing?
Apparently for the kids, you know, but yeah. Because there'll be at a party, a girl will get drunk, two or three, like, star upstanding football players, who are the school heroes, will molest the girl and then post it, go home and post it. Or their friend will be videoing them, you know, having sex with this girl, three or four guys, who's passed out drunk, you know, and doesn't even know what happened. And then a couple of days later, one of her friends calls in and says, go on YouTube. I mean, then the kids get arrested. And it's front page news because they're high school quarterbacks. You know, it's very, very strange. But I'm going to start. I have an idea for a project. And so you're going to start seeing Instagram pictures from me on LarryClark.com very often now. Because Friday, I said, a long time ago, I said Friday that I was on my way home and the show in L.A. opened Saturday and my phone broke. I had an iPhone 5, and it broke, and so I see a Verizon store, and I have the driver stop and let me out, and I jump out of the car, and I run up to the Verizon store, and there's three guards in front of the door with pistols, there's a couple of women standing there who are workers at the store, and they won't let me in, and I look inside, and there's five salesmen and five people with the salesman, and she says, no. One person to a salesman. When a salesman is finished with a person, you may go in. If you get in that line there, there's 10 people there. It wasn't a big line, thank God. Because it happened to be the first day of the launch of the iPhone 7.
Mm-hmm.
And they were expecting chaos, I guess, so they hired three armed cops, armed guards, with pistols. So I had to wait a half an hour. I'm getting more and more grumpy. But I had to have a phone. So I went inside and I bought the i7, which is the most fantastic instrument I've ever had in my hand. And it's supposed to have the best camera going today, best camera of any phone. And so I'm talking to you on my new iPhone 7, which is just, let's not advertise the phone anymore.
I think they're going to be fine.
It is the best phone of all time.
Oh, that's amazing.
Amazing, man. It does everything but make coffee, and probably the iPhone 8 will make coffee.
We're talking with Larry Clark.
So I'm going to go to Instagram because this is what the kids are doing. It's second nature.
Yeah.
But my new film, The Smell of Us, which will be in theaters in New York and around the country, and then on DVD in French with English subtitles next year.
Awesome.
It's about kids and the media and the web highway and Instagram and how kids get into trouble because of the way that you know the way it is today, which is totally different. When I was a kid, no one told you nothing. You got slapped. They would say, "Shut up, smart ass," and literally slap you, backhand you, just for asking a question. You know, there was no information. If you really had to know something, you would have to go to the library and go in the card catalog.
Yeah.
And in school, they taught you like the Dewey Decimal System, which is just a way to interpret a library card. So it was, so it's a different world today. It's quite interesting.
My last question is, what's a library? No, that's not my last question. My last question is, you know, to kind of end up where we started about danger, and just to get your take on one last thing, and we want to thank you, man, for being with us here with Larry Clark.
Sure. You're very welcome.
Can art, let alone photography, but can art be dangerous again? I guess, you know, I always romanticized these pockets of life in history where films were dangerous and exhibits were dangerous, and you've gone through it. I mean, you've been called pornographer and all these, you know.
I've been called everybody.
I know, man.
Every,
I know.
And not to diminish that,
but there's some weird compliment in that. But I guess, so can art get back to that place? Because I don't feel like we're in that place now. Can art be dangerous again?
Of course. It depends on the artist, and it happens not when the artist is trying to be dangerous. It just happens when the artist is trying to be real, and the word danger has never occurred to him, and that's when it'll happen. It will not be a planned, thought-out thing. It'll just happen, and then it'll be dangerous. Because, I mean, it was a practice in South Central that no white people go to South Central, no white people. I went out there like 7 years straight. I went out and took these kids skating, these little 14-year-old skate rats, took them skating every Saturday for a year and a half, beat them, and then took them home to their mothers because none of them had a father. They were all, you know, they were all like from just single-parent families. The mother was out working, and the kids were, you know, trying to be kids, and the peer pressure was so strong on them. These like Latino kids, the peer pressure on them to be skateboarders and wear their hair long and listen to punk rock and have a garage band was incredible, because in the ghetto, the blacks wanted everybody to act black and to wear baggy clothes and cut off all your hair and stand in the corner smoking pot, listening to gangster rap. And these kids didn't want to do that. They wanted to be punk rockers and skateboard. You didn't see any black skateboarders back then. Now you do. But back then you didn't, you know. And the reason you see black skateboarders now is because of my movie, Was Up Rockers. And because of these kids, these Latino kids from Guatemala or Colombia or Mexico, living poor kids, living in the ghetto with the blacks. It's the blacks and the Latinos, no white people. But now you see black skaters because they look and they look at the Latinos. They see those kids are having fun. Then they look